Thank you each one for your presence here this evening. I'm heartened by your efforts to come here, and I trust that we can be blessed as we're here together. I was trying to check out with my family today if it's would it have been reasonable to have done this in a more concise fashion and whatever, and I think it would have been, but it is a big subject, basically a subject with four different arms or tentacles or whatever, but these different parts play into each other well. I will probably not have quite as much time for interaction, though I want some of that because that really helps to cement it in your minds and to help flesh out where I have weak spots. So we will see. If I feel a little abrupt or cut you off a little, I understand. I kind of have the clock in some pie-shaped segments that we should be at about this point by this time, and if we labor too long on an early point, it's going to shortchange us at the end. We talked about the importance of obedience. We started in basically at the first there of Ephesians 6, the obedience, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. And we were working through that, but basically looking at the importance of obedience and how that obedience comes to pass if it's not an inherited trait or something that children naturally grow into. And so we were talking about some of the facets that help that obedience become reality. And we talked about that some, and I would like to start out, and I don't want to belabor this part because we need to get into some of the other stuff a little later, but talking about some different philosophies of child training and how these play together to flesh out that, to make that obedience flow naturally and that kind of thing. And I was debating what I would really have liked to do if we would have had plenty of time is to lay out a philosophy and then have you feed back into it and push back or contribute or whatever, and we'd let you kind of flesh it out. If we do that, it's going to take all of the evening for that first part, and there's still a lot left, I'm afraid. So maybe I will just kind of throw out an issue, allow one or two of you bravest ones to give a quick comment. Maybe I'll have something to just an additional one to throw in, and keep moving. As much as anything, these things are to get us thinking, because we probably all, as parents, have adopted certain philosophies in our child training, and maybe we have not even done it totally consciously, but maybe there are things that as we look at different views, can help us. And the fact that I'm throwing these views out is not saying that I am condoning the views entirely or condemning them. There's strengths and weaknesses in different views, but I'm going to let you help me flesh that out a little bit. The first one is allowing your children freedom to explore and learn without too much structure. It can be argued that we spend too much energy and negativity to keep our children in line. A child can learn a lot of life's lessons through experience. Too many no's can begin to define a child's whole life. We need to give our children freedom. They will find out soon enough that the stove is hot, the stairs are hard, the electric fence shocks, the gravel is rough. By constantly intervening, we stifle their creativity, their learning by doing, and they don't get to learn by cause and effects. Lessons learned in the school of hard knocks are lessons well learned. What are your comments? Ellis, you're smiling. Is your head itching? Anyone have a comment quickly? Yes. Oh, by the way, speak up really loudly. This will work for the people that are here. It's going to be a little bit hard if anyone wants to listen, but it's going to take a lot of time to run the mic back and forth. You're doing well. I mean, I could hear, but I'm just reminding you. Okay, I think that's helpful. Let me just add one other thing. A child's reasoning powers are not fully developed. I remember when Judy was babysitting a young neighbor boy, and they were wanting to climb the hayloft to go up in the hay mow. And Judy was trying to tell them they shouldn't be doing that. Well, why not? Well, you might fall and break your head or break, you know, kill yourself. Well, what do you care if we kill ourselves? I mean, it was just details, I guess. A young child may not understand why it's dangerous to climb the windmill, why it's dangerous to play on the road, why it's dangerous to put the hairpin in for your key in the outlet in the wall. So there are things, and I think what you said was very helpful. Moving on. How much should we child-proof our home? Hang our toilet paper from the towel racks and put our plants all on the high counters and put the waste baskets under lock and key. Okay. In some ways, you can delay the game by avoiding conflict. And in some ways, sometimes conflict needs to happen to move through to resolution. Nathan, I don't know if he's here tonight. He gave an excellent example last time we were meeting, how he pretty much had destroyed a plant as his parents were teaching him what no means as he kept tearing leaves off, I guess. Okay, is corporal punishment relevant today? That's something, a holdover from another era. Our parents, though well-meaning, they practiced it. We're in the 21st century now. How do you treat one wrong, insubordination, with another wrong, violence, and expect good to come out of it? How's that? Because it just works. Okay. I remember a comment that James said the other time, something about some of these alternative methods of dealing it doesn't quite seem to connect. And I'm just saying that I think there's tends to be kind of a load of guilt that builds up. And maybe inherent in a child is somewhat of a conscience. And if that conscience is violated, to realize that there's some act that needs to kind of release that, some paying of a debt or some whatever it is. And I think there's something cathartic, if I'm saying that right, about discipline that's given in the right way, in the loving way. Now today, yes.
I think often the people that get the less helpful
with this. I think I'm planning to a little later mention one of the last spankings that I remember getting from my father, and I don't think I was that terribly old. I probably needed a few more that I missed, but then I'm probably forgetting some. But anyway. Okay, one thing about it, this is a politically charged issue, and you might not choose to do this showdown in a grocery store. I think there's things that, and want to do it in a gracious way, that don't leave bruises, that kind of thing. Treat your young children as adults. Children act like children because we treat them like children. Appeal to them as adults. And I didn't say, in this first section, I'm talking basically about very young children, 2 to 5, 2 to 6, something like that. appeal to these children as adults. I want you to sit here and think about what you did. Do you think that was a good idea? How do you think what you did makes mommy and daddy feel? And while you're sitting there, I want you to think about these things and see to it that it doesn't happen again. Comments on that philosophy. Broaching these things, throwing them out, is to get your mind processing, not necessarily to say this is all wrong, this is all right, or whatever. Does that make sense? I think sometimes, though, when we are trying to deal totally as adults with children, they are somewhat limited in their reasoning ability, and at some point, I think obedience should be a learned response, and if it's enforced by some of that freeing discipline sometimes, that can be helpful possibly in moving on. optional obedience. Not so terribly long ago, I had the privilege of meeting a young man. He was tall for his age and fairly well-developed, nearly 3 years old, and his mom was kind of introducing us, and And at some point, would you like to shake Lowell's hand? I was probably offering my hand, I don't know. Apparently the young fellow didn't want to shake my hand, preferred instead to go down on the floor and kind of roll around. And mother said something like this, "Oh, so you don't want to," and she picked him up and they went on their way or whatever. At what point do we enforce suggestions? Would it have been different if I would have asked him to shake my hand? Would it? What are your comments on that scenario, briefly? Anyone else want to elaborate before I just make one quick comment? I have about two more on this, and then I want to move on. It seems to me the mother could have, and I'm not quite sure what all you were referring to. I can agree that the mother could have helped him to his feet and maybe helped him extend his right hand into my big hand. I don't know. I probably look ugly and scary to people. I don't know. But, and it could have actually happened. I don't know. Any comments on that? I felt just a little bit sad that it felt like he kind of got his way and he didn't have to follow through with a suggestion. Well, let's leave that one. Should you always explain your request to a child? Let's say you're babysitting for someone and the parent says, when you ask him to do something, would you explain it to him? Maybe a two-year-old. It seems to work better that way. A lot of life, it seems to me, that obedience should be a learned response, reflex, whatever. If we make it a matter of logic and will, then almost always there can be some discussion as whose logic is the most airtight. Okay, how should you handle, here's the one you're waiting for. How should you handle the cute naughtiness of your child? Children do and say some of the most delightful things. The little people do some naughty things that are really quite funny. So how do we handle these things? File them away for open mic on their wedding day. Repeat the story often to others. Repeat the story often in the presence of the child. Post it on social media. Anyway, what about tall tales that a child tells? And it can be very hard for a young child to differentiate between the truth and their imagination. Comments quickly on that one. This is the last one, and we have actually used our time up quite. Go ahead. I think there can be some joy in the humor and joy that a small child brings. I think it's a little bit tricky if they catch on to all the things that you're relating to others that were cute and nice and funny and all that. And at some point, the tall tales or the imagination, I remember a mother saying something like this about a child, and I think this child was already quite a bit bigger. Oh, Susie tells the biggest whoppers. And it was kind of just a matter of fact or a matter of I don't know what, not, you know, pro con or in between, I don't know what, but sort of thought, you know what, Susie's pretty big to be telling whoppers. It seems to me it might be time for someone to help her pick out what's appropriate and what's not. I see I have one more that I'd kind of forgotten about, but what about teaching reverence in the house of God? Let me just launch into a story of one of a relative or an acquaintance of an acquaintance, whatever. Of another generation, a generation older than me. How do you get your children to sit still in church? It's like this. I have a little session with my child at home. And the child is sitting here, I'm sitting there, whatever, and I have a fly swatter in my hand, and I tell my child to sit still. The child doesn't sit still, I help the child learn to sit still. After a while, the child forgets and they're moving again, then I help remind them again. I don't know for sure where we are, and I'm not sure where our generation was. To me, I'll just come out front and say that seems a little extreme to me for whatever it's worth, but maybe we have swung fairly far the other way. Is there a limit on how often a child should leave during the service? Or is there what? Just one or two quick comments, and then we will move on. Yes, Jerry. That's fine. And I wasn't coming out with a real loaded. I mean, again, just this is some food for thought. Thank you, all of you, for your comments. Let's move on now to honoring father and mother. This section I would see is especially applicable to older children, maybe even adult children. Honoring is related to obeying, but it's different. It seems that children can obey their parents without honoring them, but it is hard to honor their parents without obeying them. Does that make sense? Merriam-Webster, honor. You tell me what you think honor would be, just in a nutshell, quickly. I think we're, yes.
Respect even in disagreement.
Okay, you've taken it to an application. To regard or treat someone with admiration and respect. I think that pretty well sums it up. So the opposite would be to disrespect, disdain, ridicule, that kind of thing. If it comes to a really, really strong place, it could be cursing. It seems to me that honor is kind of like the framework, the foundation that obedience logically springs from, if that is in place. Obedience can be demanded by a stronger person dealing with a weaker one. Honor, however, is different in what way?
Voluntary.
Honor is something that is offered on the behalf of, often it would be the subject, often it would be the person that's, I mean, if we're doing rank, the son of the father or the whatever. Excellent. A position that one holds or character that one possesses begs respect of others. It can be a position or it can be character. If you're on the sidelines of a parade honoring the president, you probably won't be shooting spitballs at him as he walks by. A person of dignity, a person with character, this is just in another setting, is a person who demands or commands our respect or our honor. Where do we get this idea of honoring parents? Can somebody quote Exodus 20:12 or Deuteronomy 5:6? Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with, that it may be well with thee and that thou mayest live long in the earth. And I don't have it pulled up right here, and I'm not going too quickly, but what is a penalty for dishonoring parents? Somebody just look up Exodus 21:17 very quickly. And this would be kind of an antonym to the extreme or whatever. Does someone have it? I think he has it back there. Do you care? Go ahead, Shane. Wow, that makes it sound pretty serious. Shall be put to death. Okay, what is the promise? And who would like to elaborate just a little bit on the promise? Okay, what do you make of that? Another comment on that, anyone? Not a guarantee that you live to be 100 years old, but kind of a general principle that life will be better if you live a life free of tension. Part of the ways that you show that lack of tension is by healthy honor and respect for your parents. How do children honor their parents? And this can be children any age. Seth, how do you think children, what are ways that children honor their parents? Obeying their commands, okay. Nick, other ideas? Anyone? Up front or farther back? Frida, you're looking pretty thoughtful. How do children honor their parents? John. John.
I think that as I get older, I see the importance.
Okay, I don't know if you could all hear that. And there, I wish you would have had the mic. But even now that he has graduated from the point of most influence, direct influence by his parents, he can still honor them by feeling a responsibility to their values. This is my words. Is that close?
Yeah, that's close.
Okay. Being kind, being respectful, being gracious, being obedient, speaking well of them, respecting their wishes even when they aren't with you and will not find out. Honoring parents can continue long after a child has left home. Honoring a parent can continue even after a parent dies. There are some things that I choose to do today that in some ways honor the memory of my parents. Honoring parents. What is the parent's responsibility in this thing? Earlier we were talking about obedience. What is the parent's responsibility in this honoring thing? Marvin Nisley, what did you say about honor a while ago? It was someone over in here, I think.
Voluntary.
It's voluntary, okay? Kind of connected to that, what is the part of honor from the parent's standpoint now? Okay, we'll get into that just very shortly. We're just about jumping into that section. But there is a sense that parents earn that honor and that respect by how they relate to their children. Does that make sense, Stephen? Okay. A person in responsibility, or actually it can even be just platonic or whatever, side to side, living a life that is worthy of the respect and honor of another. Okay? This is tricky because some parents can make it relatively easy for their children to honor them, and some parents can be a pain and actually be pretty hard to honor and respect. So in a sense, this is the child's issue, and in a sense, it's our issue. That's a helpful balancing point there. I appreciate that. Let's move on to the third section. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. And I do appreciate how you're moving along, and I appreciate the interaction that we're having here. Help me flesh out some of the ways that we provoke children to wrath. And then maybe we'll back up and take them one at a time. I don't know. I'm assuming you'll have some of them that are on my list.
Assigning motives.
Keep remembering the ones that you gave because I might not come back to them. I don't think I have that one. Go ahead.
Being unreasonable in our demands.
Unreasonable in our demands. Okay. Controlling the child's future, okay. Where's that? Oh, inconsistent discipline, okay. Let's just spin off of that one a little bit wider or to another facet of that. Discipline and anger, okay. Tone of voice, okay. It's amazing what the tone of voice can do. You can do it to your farm dog. You ugly, flea-bitten mongrel. You are such a loser. Anyway, how'd we get there? Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Okay, well, let's just plunge in, and I'll try to remember the ones that you gave if I don't get to them in this list. our inconsistencies. Almost thinking someone up front here said something a little along those lines, but our inconsistencies can provoke our children to wrath. And what are ways, how are ways that we can be our be inconsistent, or how can we show that inconsistency? Just a little related to what Shane was saying. Now, I have that as a separate point, kind of. Asking things of our children that we are not willing to do or be. Asking for discipline from them when we are not living disciplined lives. Noah Nisley had a quote, or any of his direct descendants here, that Amos used to quote quite often. Does anyone remember, as it related to a father and a son, or sons? Amos quoted it pretty often, I think. The father should say, "Boys come," instead of "boys go." Something like that. Does that ring a bell? And there's limits to that, but there is a strength in a father saying, "Let's go," instead of "you go." Okay? Our inconsistencies can be ways that drive our children to wrath or provoke our children to wrath. Partiality, I don't want to spend a lot of time there. People accuse their parents of partiality. It happened back in the Bible times. There was Joseph and his brothers. There was Jacob and Esau. In some ways, even the prodigal son felt like there was some partiality going on. I'm not sure if there was. Shane, did you say something about unreasonable demands? Would you like to elaborate on that just a little bit? Okay, you are bringing two things into this discussion now. Let's separate them out just a little bit. An unreasonable demand and a retracting an unreasonable demand. What are you pointing out without saying it along those lines? Have we all made some unreasonable requests, probably, as parents? Okay? It's not fun to be trying to backtrack and saving face if you told them to do something. We can overestimate a child's maturity and ability to complete a complex task. Some children need nudging outside of their comfort zone, or they will always hold back and hope that dad will do it, or mom will do it, or whatever. And the wisdom to navigate that. But it is very nice to have thought through things that you were able to say, yes, this is something that you can do. I will help you do it, but you need to do it, or whatever. And it's difficult to save face if you make a real strong case and then decide really you had made a stupid request. How do you extract yourself from that? Let's move on. What about belittling a child? Especially in public. Reminding your 12-year-old that even a 2-year-old would know better than to do what you just did may be true, but it's not necessarily helpful at that point in building relationships. Condescension related to belittling, but it may be, belittling may be, I don't know, maybe I'm just picking at, I mean, grasping at straws here, maybe addressing an action of a child, while condescension may be attacking the personhood of a child. Does that make sense, possibly? If we would say things like this, and I trust we wouldn't, that son or daughter of mine, in spite of their heritage, can really be a pretty clueless jerk. That would be a condescension at the deep gut level. Micromanaging. How many of you are perfectionists in some areas of things? You like to see things done right when you do them? How many of you find it hard sometimes to turn over and trust someone who doesn't share that, say, those same ideals for a project? You know what I'm talking about, Willard? I do. it's difficult. If this thing is going to be done right, it's my crew and my job and my name's going to be with it, I want to have that thing, you know, that trim cut right or whatever the situation is. But it's not that helpful to train the other guys how to do it right if I always insist on doing it. And you mothers might have that six-year-old daughter there at the quilt trying to make that straight, those stitches straight, and you know they're kind of crooked and they're really pretty wide between them. And you kind of, boy, I just wish we could do that a little different. Or maybe you started your boy on the tractor and he headed off across the field. I mean, this tractor doesn't have GPS. And imagine, my brother, I think, asked me one time what I was trying to spell, but that doesn't sound right. Anyway, that's kind of beside the point, too. Related to that unhealthy perfectionism, you need to do it just exactly like this. And there's some room for discussion on how it is. And there's just really no way that my son will ever learn how to do it like I do if I don't give him an opportunity to try in those intermediate steps, probably. What about this one? Can an unhealthy family pride lead to angering your child? What would you like to say about that? Son, daughter, I would like to see your grades pop up a little bit. Your mother was very smart. Your older sister was always at the top of the class. I'd kind of like to see you up there too. Maybe we don't say it in so many words, but maybe there's a pressure that's felt. What are the things that play into that discussion, whether that's valid or isn't valid or whatever? Or what are things that just play into the discussion?
I think even at a very early age, a child can be fairly, can actually have a pretty good grasp of what's going on, and that can be very damaging if they sense that the requests are being made in order to make the parents look better. And I think even very young children can pick that up, and that's very damaging.
Okay, if the child can sense that this is basically dad window dressing his resume or whatever, and it's about him and his pride, okay, that's helpful. You kind of dodged me on just a slightly different tangent. Now I'm not quite sure what I was thinking earlier, but go ahead. What are other things? Not all children have the same scholastic aptitude. Because my brother was smart doesn't mean that I'm smart. Because my sister found school easy does not mean that I will find my school easy. The other thing, if my parents want me at the top of the class, what if I'm in a class with five other students with overachieving parents just like them that have kind of the same goal for their children? It can be very unrealistic and very painful if it feels like, and Johnny, I think, got us on a very key point, if it feels like this has to do about mom and daddy's pride. And I don't know, I think there's just an awfully lot of pressure you put your child under if you make it an extremely competitive situation. Treating adults like children. I remember a comment that someone in this community made about a young man that was probably a bit of an underachiever, had a mother who was perhaps a bit dominant. And the comment was maybe more, not sure. It in some ways I thought was fairly accurate. I'm not quite sure how kind it was, but he said something like this: if that boy ever grows up, it won't be his mother's fault. What would you like to say about treating your adults like children, giving wings, whatever, feedback. You're doing well and you're keeping them pretty concise. I really appreciate this. It's going better than I was afraid it would. Yes. Excellent. Those kinds of stories help to flesh out the concepts. Disciplining anger, we talked about that just briefly. I think we talked about that, might have talked about that the first evening, I'm not sure. There can be a lot of provoking your children to anger when we react in anger. How many of you men have never disciplined in anger? It's easy to do. And I think we've probably all been guilty, those of us that have been involved in discipline. The next one, yes, go ahead. You're wanting to open a can of worms. It's a pretty big one. say a quick comment on that, then I think we'll move on. The anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Ephesians 4:26, be angry and sin not. Is that it? Yes. Okay. I think that's helpful, and that could be kind of a checklist that we can use probably. This next one may sound on the surface to be counterintuitive, but I think we can provoke our children to anger by letting them grow up without the security of boundaries. Does that make sense? Does that resonate with you? You know, you might think on the surface, and some children might say, oh boy, I can do anything I want to do. But there's something unfulfilling and that lacks security in that over the long haul. Arlen said something way early in the meeting, and I don't even remember exactly what it was, but a child who has never learned restraint and boundaries is poorly equipped to face life and can sort of self-destruct as he tries to discover life on his own. A person who has never learned the give and take of an authority structure is very poorly equipped to face life. And I think a lot of today's society, we're reaping the harvest of some of those things. I'm not sure, I think I have it somewhere else in my notes, but as I was studying about this, I was struck with the incredible blessing that many, many, many of us, most of us have that are sitting here tonight. We're products of a traditional two-parent family, most of us, maybe not quite everyone. And we know who our parents are. We grew up, even with some dysfunction in the home, with relatively strong parents committed to each other. That traditional family, that is something that many, many people don't have that blessing of. And it's a debt, I mean, it's a gift that we have been given, I think, that is maybe partly a debt to those around us to share some of the security and blessing of that. I believe we shortchange our children, moving on. When we ask them to do something and then don't follow through with the request, this, Shane, would be a reasonable request that you've well thought through. But, you know, I don't know how everybody else finds it, but and we do it too. We have good intentions of following through on that thing that we started, but sometimes we just don't remember. During the winter, where we don't have floats set up for cattle, we're apt to run water periodically. And it is so easy to just start that hydrant and, you know, I'll set a timer or I'll just be back soon and I'll, you know, take care of that thing. And it's not impossible or totally unusual to be looking out across the lot the next day when it's been dry all winter and see there's a puddle of water out there and realize, ah. And sometimes it's our children that kind of forget to go follow through with the things that we've asked them to do. I mentioned, I think, one of the last spankings that I remember getting from my father. I can picture I was out by the old barn somewhere, maybe climbing down out of the hayloft on the through the window or coming down or something, and Lowell, did you gather the eggs? No. I guess I must not have. And I think it was something that was becoming more habitual that I just wasn't following through on. As I recall, I was given a little reminder that helped me to remember that it's a good idea to gather the eggs if that's my chore and whatever it was. Okay. I think I will leave that there and move to the last section. Bringing your children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. If I borrow a few minutes after 8:30, forgive me. I had thought when I was working on this today that this is surely another couple evenings, and you have been good, and God has been good to us this evening, and I am really grateful to where we are now. Nurture and admonition of the Lord. What would you, is there something a little more colloquial that we could use here? Someone have ESV right at their fingertips?
Discipline and instruction.
Okay, that's what they use, I believe. We talked about a lot of negative stuff. Negative. Obedience, provoking to anger, we just got through this section. Now this is proactive. Good stuff here. What does Proverbs 22:6 say? Someone remember, we looked at it the first evening. Cora wants to say it. Go ahead. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Thank you. I think that's kind of what he's talking about here, right? Discipline and instruction, some proactive way of addressing people and whatever. Okay, you did very well in that last section. How are ways that we can discipline and instruct, that we can bring up in the nurture and admonition, our children? Okay. That's almost saying my first point in just a little bit of a different way. By our consistent example. Okay? Gary.
Well, I'd start with love the Lord. So follow the Lord.
Okay. In a path of following the Lord. Okay? Nurturing them in that direction. Yes?
When I hear nurturing admonition.
Okay. Other ways that we nurture our children or discipline and instruct our children. Proactive way. Sam. Okay, good reading material. Some of you that have been involved a lot in the education of your children have done read-alouds where you have read books to your young children along certain lines that have been very helpful and formative even in those younger years. Anything else quickly? LaVon and then Ellis. Okay. A modeling not only of the judgment of God, but of the grace of Jesus. Okay. Very helpful. Marvin Nisley. Actions speak louder than words. My first point, by our consistent example, some of our most effective teaching is done without words. It is done by our example. It can work both for the good and for the bad, our example. Someone may say that person's examples or that person's actions spoke so loud I couldn't hear a word that he said. Our personal godly worldview, not exactly what Gary was saying, but if we have a good framework that we are building out of, that is very helpful to develop good frameworks out of our children. Personal godly disciplines. Let's see. Are we personally feeding on God's word? Are we personally spending time in prayer? Are we living intentionally? Are we demonstrating a life lived under the direction of the Holy Spirit? Here's another thing. It almost seems like an intangible, but one of the greatest gifts we can give our children as parents is spouses that love each other. If they see us model love and respect to each other, there's something tremendously reaffirming and encouraging about that platform. That's something that we have to be very thankful for, where we have that, and it's a tremendous blessing. By modeling servanthood, we can be egotistical, we can be the king on the throne, we can be ordering all of the servants around to do our bidding, we can live the life of a servant. Our perfect example took upon himself the form of a servant. He was made in the likeness of men. He did not hold his equality with God as something to be selfishly grasped, but he was willing to come and live among sinful man and live the life of a servant. That's a tremendous example if we can do that for our children. We can nurture our children by having an atmosphere conducive to nurture and to instruction. A home that can be free of a lot of undue distraction, and I'm not talking about music blaring only and noise and whatever, but there can be a lot of distractions. Some of the intangibles, like divided allegiances, double standards, lives where the saying and the doing just don't quite match up, don't meet. A home that lives godly values. There's some people that are just a blessing to be around. You just feel good to be in their presence. It's like there's not a mean bone in so-and-so's body. And that's a tremendous blessing when we can have a home free of pretense and pretext and live what we speak and live what we say. A home free of tension. One quick story, when my sister Miriam was at Sterling College, she did an audiovisual project with one of her friends. And a bunch of this, it was kind of a look into conservative Anabaptism, and kind of as part of that prop was sort of setting in the David L. Miller home and et cetera, et cetera. And I still remember a clip that I think, was it Beth? What was her name? Anyway, said, the thing that impressed her was the feeling of relaxation in the Miller home. And I don't know for sure what all that meant or how accurate it was, but I imagine our lifestyle, living in the country and the quietness, not a lot of radios blaring and cars honking and tires squealing or whatever, that there was something that felt, I think, to her cathartic about that that setting and that situation. And I think we can create situations by God's grace where nurture flows more naturally or more easily. This nurture can be by intentional teaching. Jerry mentioned something about family devotions. Regular family worship can be very helpful to teach and process about things from God's word. One of our children spoke about family devotions when she was little. And I quote, "I remember this as a fun, interactive time, learning Bible stories and praying together. You made them fun and dramatic." As our children get older, devotions can be a time of us sharing what a particular passage has meant to us in our private study. You know, I was reading this morning before you got up, and I was really impressed with what it says here in this passage, and I'd like to share some from there. And I think as we share fresh insights, that can be a good way to keep us up to date, and it can be a good way to keep the family involved. Processing life as life presents itself. A lot of things we face in life aren't that fun and don't seem that fair. But if we're proactive and we keep processing with our children, that can be excellent. Encourage our children to ask questions. Intentional proactive leadership If we have a wife who is very nochsichtig, what's the term? Help me. Is capable at seeing through on things. And if we kind of stay back, maybe she'll do a lot of it. We men are supposed to be the leaders. Let's be doing our part. Let's be shouldering the wheel. Be sensitive to the different stages your child is passing through. There is the age of accountability. During this time, it can be especially important to stay connected with your children. A child can be going through a lot of feelings of insecurity, needing the guiding, steadying hand of a parent, but at the same time, trying to hide those feelings of insecurity from the parent for the vulnerability that that brings. Hats off to the mothers especially, and to all of you who have been able to stay connected to your children through some of these times of adolescence and whatever. There can be faith struggles where the child is just, Mama or Daddy, I just don't understand, or could you pray with me, or could you help me? And those can be tremendous times of bonding and of nurture and instruction in the ways of the Lord. There may be guilt issues that an adolescent is dealing with. Maybe it can be an oversensitive conscience. Young child deserves our help and our attention. Maybe it's grief, a situation where life has seemed completely unfair. Our children need us during these times. We may not understand what's going on either. We may be able to do little besides be there and hold their hands and pray with them. But God wants us to be there. These are ways that we can provide nurture and admonition for our children. There can be depression in those situations. There can be a questioning of God's goodness. Who is God? Where was he? And those kinds of things. Different stages. What about the popularity or the feelings of rejection? There's the in-group and the out-group. And if your child is one of the in-group, it's a good time to get involved. Encourage some inclusivity with their in-group. And if they're part of the out-group, to try to walk with them in their situation in life. Puberty, adolescence, a lot of things can be going through your child's mind during adolescence. Physical, emotional, spiritual, hormonal things going on. It's easy for a child during those times to lose their way and to become confused. Crushes, true love, future life partners. There's a lot of drama that can come to a home when you have high schoolers and older. It's important that we're connected with our children and can walk them through some of these steps. In a brief word, stay connected. And that's easier said than done. My hat's off to all of you who've done that better than I do. I take my hat off to my good wife. I give credit to my children as well. Many or most nights, at least at a certain stage after a youth activity, when we were already in bed, children would stop by our bedroom to report on the evening. There is a connection. We need to maintain those connections and to help walk with our children as we lead them in nurture and admonition. In conclusion, you may be saying, this business about harmonious homes with cheerful children and patient parents sounds like something from the Pathway Publishers. Some of you were talking about that the other evening. And maybe you're saying, and I actually have a pretty good plug to put in for one of their publications just directly here. You may say it's certainly not that where you're at. Your experience is more like a fractured family with obstinate offspring and a frustrated father. How do we move from where we are in our families to where we want to be? Can someone quote Psalm 127, verse 1? Except the Lord, the first part, I'm not sure if that second phrase is right in there or not. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I taught some on the family in India in one of my presentations, and I built significantly off of this passage, and I was kind of hoping to bring that in. But seriously, except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Catch a vision for what could be. realize it is a joint effort to make harmony happen. We have all failed and fallen short. Honest confession and apology is a tremendous first step toward healing. That can go both ways, if you have teenage children, if you're parents. Family counsels over devotions can be starting steps. Seek input from your children. With older children, you can ask them, how have we made it hard for you to obey and respect us? In what ways have we provoked you to anger? How are ways that we have nurtured you in godly ways? That input can be instructive to move forward. Seek help from others, Sam, from writers. Actually, there was a very good article in the last Young Companion. Charles Diller, I think, wrote a book, Generational Bridges. For those of you that haven't burned your subscription to the Young Companion, that's an excellent article. It's a reprint. I mean, there might be a few things I would question, but a reprint from a Rod and Staff publication, and he speaks a whole lot about these transitioning generations, and it's has some very good things. Ken Sandy, how many of you recognize that name as an author? He has written some excellent material on peacemaking. He has one specifically directed peacemaking for families. I haven't read in that amount. I don't know how much. Judy speaks very highly of that. I am blessed by your participation and your help this evening. Not that I've given you the answers, but I have hopefully stimulated our thinking that we can get a vision for what could be and reclaim some of the ground that we've lost if we've lost ground. And I thank you for your indulging me these extra 10 minutes and for your patience. Any comments in closing? Anyone?